Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, and this is going to be a fun one. It's going to be a special episode, and its title is From Diagnosis Back to Life. I got with me Tracy Palfrey, who is a personal trainer, health educator from here in Atlanta that we go back several years. We've worked together in the past, and she's brought quite a crew today to talk about this important issue. Welcome, Tracy.
Hi.
So, Tracy, tell us what you were thinking when you said, you know what, Lee, this would be a good idea to put together a group and talk about this.
Well, it started out, you know, as many things do, one area. And then as I think about it and all the different fabulous people that I know that contribute to healthcare, it expanded into a whole other thing. So even though our theme is diagnosis back to life, it's going to include multiple components such as community awareness, which is key to getting the right information out to the right people that's suffering or may be diagnosed with one of the two diseases that we'll talk about today, which is diabetes and peripheral artery disease. There's nutrition component that goes with that. There is the community awareness component that goes with that. There is a physician provider approach that goes with that, and also massage therapy and pharmaceutical that goes with that. So it's multiple tiered. It's not simplistic in nature, but if we put our great minds together, we're able to really totally treat the patient. Most people, when they're diagnosed, there's a little bit of confusion. There's a digestive period of what exactly is happening to them. And then from that, we have to figure out how to transition them from the clinical approach to back to their healthy lifestyle. So some people don't even lead healthy lifestyles and don't even know what that looks like. So part of the goal for today is to really shape that picture and give people more of a tangible point of how to really operate from this.
And so they can understand kind of what are some of the elements of a healthy lifestyle and what are some of the resources out there maybe they weren't aware of. So now let's just introduce everybody in the room and then let's start it off, I guess, with...
Yes. So Dr. Desmond Bell... who is a podiatrist and the founder of Save a Leg, Save a Life. There's Dr. Dolores James, a professor from University of Florida, health educator, nutritionist. I mean, she's my superhero a little bit. there's Shalini. You know, she's a really good friend of mine, but a stellar massage therapist, really knowledgeable as it pertains to pharmaceuticals because she is a clinical pharmacist. And then there's Liddell with his company, Executive Armor, who I admire, who has an entire different approach to plant-based nutrition and how
We're going to get into each of those individually. And who do you want to kick it off with?
Dr. Bell.
All right. Welcome, Dr. Bell.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, tell us a little bit about Save a Leg, Save a Life. How are you serving folks?
Well, we are a nonprofit organization, and we really started out of the practice that I run in Jacksonville, Florida, many years ago. But in 2015, we incorporated as a nonprofit organization.
What was the practice you had?
So I'm a specialist, so I basically have been focusing on lower extremity preservation and amputation prevention for over 20 years now. So I'm a wound specialist primarily.
And then, so then at some point you were like, I have to start an organization to really kind of get in there and help people?
Well, you know, it was really more like we were seeing some things coming into our office that were not acceptable. And essentially we identified teaching moments. And when I say this, we'd see patients coming into our office with misdiagnosed conditions or even something as simple as a bandage not being put on properly. So taking that into account, how do we start improving things? Teaching local healthcare providers, and one thing led to another.
And so this was just kind of a natural outgrowth of your practice, right? You were just seeing these things that were like preventable, and the people didn't know what they didn't know, and these are kind of fixable.
That's correct. And, you know, part of that cliche is if you don't do something about it, then you're part of the problem. So this, knowing what's going on with diabetes and how it's exploded over the past 20 years that I've even been in practice, we've got to do better. And so much of what we see is truly preventable. So that's really the impetus of our foundation. We're trying to prevent lower extremity amputations that are often unnecessary.
And then those are happening maybe more often than people realize?
What's really, really staggering, a statistic that I heard several years back just kind of blew me away. Half the amputations that are done in our country are done without even a simple vascular test or further assessment. So basically, amputation in many cases in our country is done as a first-line treatment without any type of prior testing. And it's inexcusable because we've got technology that can be utilized, but we've got to get this message out to not only providers, but to the public as well.
So that, I mean, that's shocking to me that that extreme kind of to cut off a part of someone's body is the first move.
Exactly. And it's, to me, it's inexcusable, but you know,
so how does that happen? Like what's the, what, I mean, the system has to be so broken that that is kind of makes sense to somebody, right? Like they're not doing this to be, you know, mean people, terrible people. They're doing this because this makes sense. This is how things are.
Partly it's, you don't know what you don't know. The other thing is there's a perception that it's more cost effective to amputate an extremity, but in reality, it's a lot more cost effective to prevent it from happening because, you know, simply taking a leg off doesn't solve problems. It creates new problems for the patient and for the healthcare system too. So we've got this whole population now that's experiencing diabetes. When I was a resident and I trained back up in Philadelphia in 1996, I still remember a co-resident talking to one of our newly diagnosed vets who had diabetes. And at the time, we had 16 million people with diabetes. And he said, don't worry, this is a good time to have been diagnosed. We're really close to a cure. So here we are in 2019, and we have over 30 million people with diabetes now. And statistically, if somebody develops a wound on their foot or leg that doesn't heal, they've got about a 50% chance of being dead within 5 years. You compare that to breast cancer, everybody knows the pink ribbon. Well, guess what? The five-year mortality rate for breast cancer is about 12%. Prostate cancer is about 6%. So where's the outcry for this? And we've got so many more people.
So is this like a PR problem? You need a run or a ribbon?
So we do. We actually do have a ribbon, and we've created a little campaign. We call it the White Sock Campaign. So every September, which happens to be PAD Awareness Month, PAD stands for peripheral arterial disease. It's one of the complications of diabetes that can lead to amputation. And a lot of times it starts with the loss of a toe and then part of a foot.
But so they're slowly amputating pieces.
It's one of the most undignified ways you can leave this world. And it truly is analogous to cancer. And this is the misconception too. You know, I mentioned those statistics a second ago. The only thing that's worse in terms of five-year mortality rate is lung cancer and pancreatic cancer. So it's disturbing to me when I see patients in my practice and I explain to them how if we don't get that wound healed up quickly, their five-year mortality rate is bleak. It gets their attention. Yeah, and I throw this out there. I say, you know, if somebody was diagnosed with a simple skin cancer, well, there's a call to arms and action and there are methods that are followed, and there's never a denial as far as treatment goes. But what we see in our world is so often, you know, denial to access to care that's really needed.
So when you say that, who's denying the access to care?
Well, a lot of this comes down to insurance companies, which is frustrating. We've got technology that, again, is often underutilized, but there's a perception that what we're doing maybe is not, you know, the most cost-effective thing. In reality, again, it's saving money in the long term.
So in some ways that if cancer's inside your body and you're treating it there where no one sees it, then there's paths and then the insurance blesses the process. But because it's outside your body, then they don't want to kind of take care of that?
I don't know if that's – you raise a good point. Now, you know, the thing is, though, diabetes affects every cell in your body. So a lot of the things that we do see are just really symptomatic of far worse what's going on inside.
Right.
You know, a healthy person doesn't develop a non-healing wound. So I think if we can be more proactive in our approach to this too and get people to understand what's at stake, then they'll start to take it more seriously too. And then we can start to prevent those amputations, again, that are so unnecessary from happening.
So now, so what do you think of this community approach to solving this, or at least making a positive impact to this? Is that the only way?
Well, community approach is a big part of it. And the part that we're doing too is, you know, several things, you know, education at the community level, but also at the patient level, as well as providers. But we've got to have a big bullhorn in a sense and really start getting this word out there. And you alluded to a ribbon. We do have a ribbon, and we are using social media now to start to create awareness. Mm-hmm. We have this thing called the White Sock Campaign, where we ask people to put on one white sock, calls attention to the lower extremity, post it on social media, and then it creates teaching moments too. So through education and then also some community outreach through philanthropic works, we do raise money and we assist patients who are in need, maybe to get a pair of diabetic shoes or wound care supplies or whatever it is that they need. Our board of directors meets, and we generally will take care of anybody who requests our help.
So now, in your perfect world situation, because diabetes, is this a self-inflicted wound? Like, do people who have diabetes, is it because of their own behavior that they're doing that is contributing to this? Or is this some genetic thing that's going to happen and there's nothing you can do about it?
That is a great question. And, you know, there can be a perception that people bring diabetes on themselves. However, there are many inherent risk factors. So there are hereditary factors, there are aging factors, and you know, what we've really seen that kind of speaks to your point is that we've had an increase in type 2 diabetes, which is often weight related.
And what's the difference? What's type 1 and what's type 2?
Right. So type 1 is basically where your body is no longer producing any insulin by way of the pancreas.
That's just kind of a genetic fluky thing?
It tends to be. It used to be more what they would call juvenile diabetes or mm-hmm. brittle diabetes. But the bottom line is your body is not producing any of that necessarily insulin that transports glucose to all the cells in your body. Type 2 is when your body is still producing the insulin, but the body mass has become so large that it can't keep up with the demand. So there's got to be some type of a supplement, usually in the form of an oral medication. So this is where I think the perception comes in, that a lot of times the diabetes is brought on the individual. But there are risk factors, as I mentioned, hereditary. If you have a family member or family members that have diabetes, if you're certain ethnic groups, African-American, Latino, Native American, and so on, you're at a higher risk. So there are a lot of things that come into play for this.
But does that complexity make it an easier thing to dismiss? Like, oh, we don't have to pay that much attention or give them as much attention in terms of investing my emotions into this because it's self-inflicted. Like, they brought that on themselves, so that's kind of on them. Where breast cancer, they were just going about their business. They get that, and then, I can empathize more for that.
Yeah, no, and this is one of the common perceptions, too. And yet the reality is that a lot of people don't even know that they're diabetic. They find out after the fact, and so then where are the resources to teach them how to manage properly?
Right.
They just are thrown, basically into it. And they're, where's the support for this? So we're truly lacking in our ability to convey the importance of all of this and how the individual can really manage their own care.
And even if they are kind of predisposed or they're in a group that is more likely to get it, there's things they can be doing proactively before it becomes a problem, right? Like, that's not a death sentence, knowing you're predisposed. There are still actions you can take.
That's correct. And it is heartbreaking when you hear certain stories. I know a lot of the Native American population, through colleagues across the country, I've heard stories where, people think that, it's a foregone conclusion. I'm going to have an amputation at some point.
It doesn't have to be that way.
It doesn't have to be that way. So by being proactive, knowing your risk factors, and then managing a lot of this through healthy lifestyle choices, through proper nutrition, exercise, goes a long way. I mean, if somebody feels like they can't exercise, well, guess what? Just even walking a little bit,
right,
and then increasing it over time.
It's not like something that I have to run marathons. Just take the first steps.
Yes, absolutely. And if you're concerned, it's always good, find a personal trainer, find somebody. Supervised exercise is absolutely the way to go. We know this through cardiology rehab, but also, for something like where you're trying to improve your lifestyle. It's certainly doable, but you just can't give up.
Right. I think a lot of times they see, especially if you're overweight or you're out of shape, you see it's like a bridge too far. So why even bother starting? And then all you're doing is getting, it's exacerbating the situation.
Yes. And it further adds to some of the psychosocial components of the depression that can go with this too. And the reality is, you know, back in the day, I was actually a trainer myself, and people would come to me all the time. How do I lose weight? How do I, you know, do this and do that? I say, well, let's start out with some math, basic thing. Let's look at how many calories your body needs each day. So let's look at your current weight. Add a zero to that. That's about how many calories that you're just needing for metabolic function. So if you start decreasing your caloric intake and start to exercise just by walking, just eliminate some of the unnecessary calories that are empty calories in many cases, you can really start to be on the path to a better lifestyle for sure.
And it doesn't have to be all or nothing. Something is better than nothing.
Something is better than nothing. And again, from my perspective, I don't wish this on my worst enemy. The things that I've witnessed in my practice over the years are heartbreaking. It's truly the most undignified way to leave this planet. And to see the things patients go through, it's not only affecting them individually, but their support system,
right? The
too.
Family, the caregivers, like this. Once that domino falls, a lot of other people are affected by this.
This is correct, and it's the emotional roller coaster that I've seen again, a parallel to cancer. The patient's life revolves around going to the doctor, this and that, hospitalizations, and it's never ending. And I look at my typical patients, and I see the number of medications that they're on, and it's just mind blowing, really. And our bodies were not designed to put up with this. I mean, we're really pretty simple creatures. And if we take care of our bodies,
they'll take care of us.
They certainly will.
Now, what do you need more of? How can we help?
Well, if anybody is interested in learning more about our foundation, we do have a website. It's thesalsal.org. That's thesalsal.org, which stands again for the Save a Leg, Save a Life Foundation. We are on social media, Facebook. You can learn a little bit more about what we're doing. If you want to contribute to our cause, rest assured that all the money that we raise goes into our philanthropic account, and we do identify, again, patients in need. We have a voucher system, and rest assured the money will go towards its intended purpose.
And that the acronym Save a Life, Save a Leg, Save a Life, that's not just kind of lip service. That's a fact, right? Like, this can save your life if you can kind of get ahead of this before it becomes a real problem.
That's correct. And it really, one last thing, Lee, it really reflects on the term, what it means, not only preventing amputation, but we're trying to connect the dots to all some of the other bad things that go with diabetes. So it's not only affecting the leg, but that lack of circulation to the leg that we talked about from PAD, it's the same disease process that's going on in the cardiac vessels or in the neck. So you may, in a sense, prevent a heart attack or a stroke if you get screened for peripheral disease early on, which is a simple thing to do.
Good stuff. Well, Dr. Bell, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you very much.
All right, Tracy, smart people in this room, huh?
I know. I don't even know why they're friends with me, honestly. But
who do you got next?
I have Dr. Dolores James.
Welcome, Dr. James.
Thank you.
How are you going to beat that act? That was a tough one.
Well, we're on the same team, so we don't need to beat each other.
So tell us what you're up to.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to point out is not just the amputation or the limb loss, that diabetes is actually the seventh leading cause of death. So while we're focused on limb preservation, we do have to understand that when we talk about the top 10 causes of death in the U.S., diabetes is number seven. The other thing is that about 24%, 30 million people have diabetes. About 24% of those are undiagnosed. So that means that a lot of people are going around not knowing that they have diabetes. And that's the reason why screening is important, community awareness screening that we're going to be doing this afternoon, as well as having annual checkups. But diabetes is at an epidemic proportion. It is an epidemic now. It's not just something that's casually happening. The same way right now that we're kind of outraged about the measles outbreak and the measles epidemic, we're not outraged about the diabetes. And diabetes is...
It affects way more people.
Affects more people, but affects quality of life, affects families.
Yeah.
And also, I teach nutrition. I teach chronic disease, and it is one of the most horrible diseases. My brother lost a leg to diabetes, and it started off one toe at a time. And even when I went, the doctors had not done any type of screening or anything preventive. It was just they were going to amputate the whole foot. So when I said, what about, you know, the hyperbaric chamber? Have you done this? Have you done that? It's like, no, amputation was the default. And so so he lost toes and then, you know, a leg. But so I'm very committed to, you know, to this cause.
Right, it's personal.
It's personal. And then also the fact that it is something that can affect all of us. I want us to not get into the victim blaming. Because, again, sometimes some of it has to do with our family history and the fact that a lot of times I think with diabetes, it's one of those things that we know that they're treatment. So whether or not it's insulin or metformin, the little pill, sometimes it's not taken as seriously because I can always just take a pill. I can always just take a shot. And
because they think it's manageable.
They think
so
it's
then
manageable.
There's no urgency.
Right. So if
I'll just get to it later when it gets bad.
Mm-hmm. Right. So if we talk about diabetes running its full course, we're talking about probably the number one reason why people are on dialysis, the number one cause of blindness other than accidents. We're talking about the kidney failure. We're talking about the heart disease and everything like that. If you can prevent diabetes through your lifestyle, you'll also prevent some other diseases.
Right.
The hypertension, the heart disease, because really the lifestyle approach will hit most chronic diseases. And so heart disease, that's another side effect, you know, from diabetes.
So now as a public health representative, and you know that these lifestyle choices and the lifestyle it sometimes contributes poorly to people's lives, how do you go about kind of solving this? Seems like such a systemic problem. How can you kind of tactically kind of get your arms around this so you can help the individuals that are suffering?
That's a big question. I think that what we can do as a community, so there's a team approach when we're talking about the medical approach. And the medical approach really is a sick care approach.
Right.
When we talk about the community approach, we're saying that everyone has skin in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about...
Like when you say a community approach, define community. Right. Like who are the constituents of this community?
So the community approach, I would say it involves the nonprofit organizations.
Okay, first it's around the patient, right? The individual is going to have a community around them to support and help educate them so they can make better choices.
I would probably say the community support is putting our arms around diabetes itself. You know, putting our arms around the community and understanding the risk factors, understanding the sheer number of people in our individual communities that are suffering from diabetes.
And they may not even be aware of it.
Not be aware of it. Or even if you're aware of it, you think, oh, I take my little pill.
Right.
So part of it is if we identify who the real enemy is, and it's not the patient, it's what's attacking our community. And if we take that approach, then everyone needs to have skin in the game. So we have raising the awareness.
Right. So that's where the nonprofits, that's where the government, things like that are out there educating the population that this is a problem. Here's some steps that can alleviate this. You don't have to go down this road if you kind of do some of these lifestyle changes.
And I'm actually going to bring it even down to a smaller level. I'm going to bring it down to the faith-based organizations. Mm-hmm. I'm bringing it down to the churches. Because if you look at each one of them, the percentage of their population that has diabetes, but within those congregations also, you have doctors, you have nurses, you have people. Not only that, you have a physical space where we can provide screenings, where we can do education programs.
Right.
A lot of large churches have kitchens where we can do cooking classes.
Right, nutrition.
Exactly, nutrition. We can develop walk-in clubs. So it's not necessarily, when we're talking about the community, we're talking about how are we going to, first of all, make health a legacy. I'm a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Culture of Health leader. How do we make health a priority in our lives? We talk about our culture. A lot of time we talk about our food, our music, our art, the things that we want to pass to our children. I don't think too many people say, I want to pass a legacy of good health onto my children.
And then it's kind of reframing what the mission is for some of these groups, right? Like you mentioned the kind of the spiritual side of this. So when you reframe what their mission is and you include health and good nutrition and things like that, that's part of serving their kind of members.
And we
right?
tap the nerve because all faith-based organizations teach that the body is a temple.
This is a temple. So start.
So we now have to a call to arms
and give them real tactical mm-hmm. things they can do to treat their yes. body like the mm-hmm. temple that they at least give lip service to, right?
Right. And there's so mm-hmm. many congregations in neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So if we talk about little cells that can right. start in a great movement.
That's right.
The other thing has to do with, for me, when we talk about physical activity, not everyone can go to a gym.
Right.
And when I work in the community, sometimes the neighborhoods don't have places to exercise.
Right.
So we have to begin to think about even green spaces. Some neighborhoods are just not safe. And so it's easy for us to say, just get out and exercise. Well, depending on the neighborhood.
Right. It's not that easy.
It's not that easy.
But there are stuff you can do in your home.
So there are things that you can do in your home. And again, if you have community centers or even some of the churches right. during the week that can open
right.
up
they
for
have
exercise
the space,
classes
right.
and spaces and things like that. And so that
safe spaces.
Safe spaces.
Right.
Safe spaces. So I think the other thing is we don't value or we have not made a priority what I would say community health workers. These would be non-clinical professionals who can be trained to do screenings, who can be trained to do home visit, who can do peer education, who can build support groups. And so while we have the medical team that can deal with the clinical aspect, we also need people who can be out there in the community.
Right, the boots on the ground exactly. that are out there mm-hmm. creating engagement and working with those people one-on-one.
One-on-one and sometimes as a group.
Sure.
During the election year, everyone's walking around with a clipboard trying
exactly.
to get you to sign up.
A lot of people got fired up about that, right?
Yeah, right.
This is the day-to-day mm-hmm. stuff that's impacting
exactly.
their families.
Exactly. So the awareness is in the seventh cause of death in this country. About 24% of diabetics are walking around undiagnosed. And if you say, well, I'm just pre-diabetic. Pre-diabetic means it's coming your way. The train is on
right.
the way. So that's a wake-up call.
It should be.
That's a
wake-up
call.
You
got to
take it seriously.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
So now, why do you think there is that disconnect that even when people are kind of told, okay, you're pre-diabetic, they still are kicking the can down the road. They're not taking the action and they're not compliant to some of these kind of lifestyle changes that can make a big impact. Because I know like in some of the like cardiac care, somebody has open heart surgery, you know, within 6 months and a year, they're back to the same behaviors that got them, you know, their chest cut open to begin with. Like why doesn't an individual kind of use these situations as, hey, this is a wake-up call. I got to do something.
Well, that's the reason why I think psychologists also need to be on the team
exactly.
because behavior change is hard.
Right.
Especially changing your food habits is one of the hardest thing that you'll ever do
mm-hmm.
because food brings comfort. Food has so much meaning. And when life beats up on you, it's easy for you to just go home. And, you know, food is medicine one way or the other. We have good medicine and we also have
right.
bad medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we kind of get to this whole thing about using your food as medicine, but also people self-medicate with food.
Right.
And the foods that self-medicate are usually, again, going to be the highly processed food, the foods that's high in sugar and everything like that. So I would probably say the reason why I think the diabetes part I think the same approach, whether or not it's high blood pressure or any type of disease. But most of the time, we don't get a wake-up call until we've had a diagnosis. Now, we should have had the wake-up call when Big Mama was diagnosed
mm-hmm.
or when some other family member.
Look, when you go to a family reunion, you're looking at your that's your chart, your health chart there, right?
Exactly. You look around and that's there. But if you're at the family reunion, what will happen, they'll just shoot up a little extra insulin so that they could eat the banana pudding and hit
right.
the barbecue and everything like that. So because we know that there's medication, there also is this perception, you have to die of something.
Right.
you know, you can jog and get hit by a bus.
Right. You They'd know. Love to bring that person exactly. out. Look how fit that right. person is.
Right. Yeah, they drop that.
Right.
Right. So the apathy, but part of it is this whole thing of you have to die of something and I'm going to go out smiling.
So you got to. So that's an important point that you have to add some of this behavioral mm-hmm. change in psychology as part of this community that's mm-hmm. serving this group, right, in order mm-hmm. for change to really happen. Because intellectually, I think we all understand eat less, exercise more, that no one is debating. That's not for debate anymore, right? It's just how do you make these kind of small changes that lead to big changes down the road?
And I don't think we understand also that food is addictive. Mm-hmm. Food is manufactured, the flavors, everything for us to want more and more. And then also if your blood sugar is out of control, when it drops, what do? You eat more sugar.
More sugar, right.
You know,
and then
you know,
it creates a spiral.
So it does create that spiral. So I would probably say the awareness should be, number one, is that it's a killer and it's a slow death and it's a horrible death. It's an ugly death. And the caregivers and the caregiver burden, someone is taking care of you. Someone is taking you to your doctor's appointment.
Right. So maybe if you kind of reframe this in mm-hmm. your mind that this isn't just affecting me anymore. This is affecting other people. This is affecting my neighbor. This is affecting my sister, brother, whoever's taking me, my kid, whoever that person is. Do I want to be that burden on this kind of these caregivers because of choices I'm making?
And I think, again, if we wrap our hands around a community mm-hmm. and say, look how many people in this zip code
right.
have been diagnosed with diabetes. And this is something we're talking about. Time lost from work. We're talking low productivity.
Right.
We're talking about how it's hitting the healthcare system. I just think the same way we would talk about no to gun violence, no to street crime and everything like that, we have to get health on the radar of the community
right.
for us to say, actually, more people are being killed by diabetes than maybe gun violence.
Right. That's not the headlines you're seeing.
That's not the headline that you're seeing.
Right.
That's not the headline you're seeing.
So now what could we do to help you get the word out? What do you need more of?
Well, I think that if we begin with the local community, and I'm going to still go back to the faith-based organization, I'm going to go back to the work site.
Mm-hmm.
Because
so wherever people mm-hmm. are congregating.
Wherever we live, work, play.
Part of that mission should be to educate mm-hmm. and to give them opportunities to get better in some of these lifestyle.
And the schools, because we're now having more children who are being diagnosed with type 2
right.
diabetes. That's completely related to diet and lifestyle. Because, again, when I worked in public health and I worked in the poor rural counties, and I would wonder sometimes a mother would have $1 left and she'll go to the vending machine and buy Pepsi.
Mm-hmm.
But I looked at the look of sheer joy and delight on that child's
right.
face, because mama, her last dollar, put a smile on my face.
Right.
Okay. So we have to look at it also for people who don't have much, that what we call the little pleasures in life. And so if it's things like delayed gratification, the payoff later, because the quality of life, you can live 10 more years, but I might be in a wheelchair.
Right.
Or it might be now trying to apply for disability, and those disability claims are being turned down more and more. So I think that the big awareness, and I think that all of us need to take responsibility. I'm not going to go to the family reunion and guilt trip you anymore, because I really want to heal relationships.
Right, but also at the family reunion, you could have healthy
exactly.
food choices.
We could have healthy food choices.
We can do some physical activity here.
Exactly.
We don't have to,
not just a tug of war.
Right, exactly.
You know,
but we can kind of,
exactly.
kind of sneak it in.
We can redefine and reimagine what family
right.
time can be like.
And change the little pleasure from a sugar snack right. to something healthy, you know, an apple. That could be right. a little pleasure too.
And I think also that when we look at family health histories, most of us don't know our family health history. So for example, did you ever say, what did grandpa die of? Mm-hmm. What did grandma die of? What runs in our family history? So I think that while everyone is doing 23andMe and Ancestry.com,
I think we need to
also know our family health history, because we may be passing it down.
Right.
And so that just means that we need to be a little bit more vigilant. Health is something that's good. It's not like we're trying to deprive you of something else.
We're trying to live a more vibrant life longer.
Yes. And re-educate your taste buds.
Right.
And it takes a while to re-educate your taste buds. Yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
All right, Tracy, who do you got next?
Mr. Liddell Hill. Since we're going to, Dr. James brought up some very interesting key points, especially the food side, because that is where we always default to, and re-educating and reimagining, you know, how to delight our taste buds. And Liddell can speak directly to that.
All right, Liddell.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I would like to say that a lot of the problem in today's society is we don't understand ourselves. And to understand ourselves is understand what our organs and cells require to work efficiently. All diseases are a pathogenesis relatively to the inflammatory process of the body. We now have type 3 diabetes, which is brain abnormalities. Brain abnormalities is coming from a lack of certain nutrients, one being magnesium. Magnesium activates 2,600 enzymes. So you have to think about this. Are we really practicing what our indigenous ancestors practice? No, we're not. We're consuming more of these synthetic toxin type of chemical compounds that has a direct effect on our liver. Understanding these organs and understanding, we'll go to the liver. Just understanding the liver alone, it has three phases. Phase one gets rid of all large man-made chemical compounds. Well, guess what? We slow down production of all enzymes, digestive enzymes and systemic enzymes. So that being said, if we're going to pollute our bodies with these large man-made chemical compounds, we are creating our systems to become more of an acidosis system. All viruses and bacteria live in an acidic environment. That is one of the first levels of starting with type 2 diabetes, is when our body's in an inflammatory state. So what should you do, or what could you do? Well, probably pick up more leafy greens, because those are anti-inflammatory compounds that you're consuming.
So now your premise is that plant-based diet is the best diet?
No, because I believe in moderation. But do understand that when you put certain things in your mouth, it has a direct connection on alkalinity and acidity in the body. So it's got to be a perfect
range. Processed food, for sure.
Absolutely.
Right. If you're going to take a baby step, that's a good baby step, is to remove processed food.
Exactly.
Because plant-based food, sugar is a plant-based food.
Well, it depends. Are you talking about stripping it from the natural origins of the cell, or you talking about refining?
Well, it's still coming from a plant, either one.
Sugar cane. If you eat sugar cane, it's better for cholesterol versus refined white sugar. Refined white sugar, it affects the white blood cells. It delays these white blood cells 10 minutes of fighting any forms of diseases that we have in our bodies, versus cane sugar, pure cane sugar.
So now, so what's your recommendation for, you got a person that is maybe not, doesn't have the best diet. What are some of the practical, tactical baby steps they can be taking to improve their health through nutrition?
Well, baby steps, I believe that the majority of the population should probably consume about 70 to 75. I'm about 90% raw plants. Always keep the protein in a single digit. Always keep fat in the single digit. Your body requires complex carbohydrate. That is its fuel source. And then next is fat. Our nation is saturated with meat. We love meat. We love gluten. We love dairy. The food sources that's out there today has not even close to the natural compounds that our ancestors grew up consuming. So you need to pretty much do some research, study. Like the doctors, both doctors stated earlier, find out what that weak link is in your family history. Because usually when you have a weak link, say, for instance, you have a weak pancreas. By the way, the pancreas is about 6 inches long. It normally turns on at night. That is your repair mechanism. So when you destroy and hurt the pancreas, you're hurting yourself, because when it turns on, it secretes the most abundant amount of enzymes anyways, 1,200 to 1,500 milliliters of all enzymes. Matter of fact, the two main enzymes, trypsin and chymotrypsin, goes after all cancer cells, goes after any forms of exogenous proteins. Exogenous proteins are proteins intruding the body. I have a really good high school friend that was a collegiate athlete. Both of his legs amputated. He was the well-to-do guy. I was the one. I studied biochemistry for 30 years. So my grandfather was a medicine man. I grew up in a very, very small country town in Lebanon, Tennessee. My grandfather couldn't read, write, or drive, just a team of mules and a tractor. He's the one that taught me about herbs and plants, even though he didn't understand the compounds. So I got involved with studying the compounds. My best friend is a gentleman named Sanjay Gupta. Sanjay Gupta and I always had debates. He's the first one that gave me a medical book, so I got involved with being passionate about learning chronic and debilitating illnesses. Once I had the clear understanding of chronic and debilitating illnesses, it took me right back to what my grandfather was teaching me. That's how I came up with a lot of my formulas. And the formulas that I have, which I'm sure there's others out there because I'm mostly plant-based driven, is to help the pancreas, the gallbladder, the liver, every organ in the body to work more efficiently, understanding that as we age, we have to change our eating protocols to consume certain compounds for our age group. Because what a 20-year-old person can eat because of the abundant amount of enzymes is totally different from a 54-year-old like myself can consume. So as we age, we actually don't even really need as much food. If we do consume food, it should be bioavailable. So I recommend and suggest to all the listeners out there that they should be consuming more plants, because organs, every organ, every cell in the human body requires these particular types of compounds to work efficiently.
Now, isn't that some of the challenge in that as you age, most people are more affluent as they age? They use food for other things other than just sustenance. They use it as comfort and emotional and celebration. And then it's a trap that I have more money, resources, and I celebrate with food. So then I'm going to eat kind of not great food.
Well, of course, I work with tons of celebrities out there that we watch on television every day. And the accessibility of their food choices, that's when I come in and re-educate them. Statistically speaking, well, actually, there was a study done in men alone, because, you know, prostate cancer is at a rise right now. 100 years ago, men's testosterone level was 20 times higher than it is today. Estrogen level is running rampant. What creates estrogen? Your body's off balance, inflammation, acidity. Anytime you go to the gym, we always talk about going walking, exercising. Well, most people don't even understand that their body's in an acidic state. In an inflammatory state. The best thing to consume is not some protein that we were taught in the 80s that's going to build muscles. No, it's more of a plant-based, because it buffers some of the acidity or the inflammation that's going on in the body.
So what would be your kind of top five foods that people should eat more of, and what would be top five they should eat less of?
One being garlic. I love garlic. Garlic has 33, 35 different sulfur compounds. It stimulates the proliferation of lymphocytes, so it comprises of about 25% of the white blood cell. It's going to go and attack any forms of exogenous proteins. Once again, exogenous proteins are proteins intruding the body, so it engulfs it. And when it engulfs it, your body goes through microphase and phagocytosis. So it just breaks it down.
So how do you eat your garlic every day?
I put it in a smoothie. I have the smoothie.
Garlic smoothies?
Yeah, it's interesting. I have the smoothie. I call it I don't know if you know what the dendritic cells are. Dendritic cells are these cells that communicate with the immune system. It's like where the duodenum connects with the small intestines. So it says exactly what's going on in the human body. So what's a dendritic smoothie? What it causes? It causes the pancreas, the gallbladder, the kidneys, all of them, to purge. Because you got to understand, if you in your 30s, 40s, and 50s, you have accumulated a great deal of toxins. These are called lipophilics. They're in the fat cells. They're underneath the skin. If you don't get them out, by converting it into a lipophilic, I mean a hydrophilic, then it's going to come and get you sooner or later. One of my clients, I'm going to give you this quick story. One of my clients was, he's a cigar smoker. I'm not going to throw his name out there. But he says, you know, I get all kinds of names, from molecular health specialist to tree bark. He calls me tree bark. He says, tree bark, you know, my prolactin levels are out of control. And I'm like, well, you know, you're smoking a cigar. It's got cadmium. There's about 8 orthogenic processes to cadmium that facilitates 800 different types of epithelial cancers. Those are the most common cancers. So your estrogen level, everything is completely thrown off. If you consume isothiocyanate, which is a compound that's found in a lot of cruciferous vegetables, Brussels sprouts, things like that, it metabolizes carcinogen, vitamin D. It's just simple things that the community is not getting this particular type of education that can change their health.
So now your recommendation is more
garlic, Brussels sprouts, leafy plants. If you got diabetes, Swiss chard. Eat Swiss chards, fenugreek. There's a lot of different choices that we can consume. The ones that I totally avoid is gluten. And if you do, have it in moderation, because it causes all forms of intestinal permeability. And we know that all diseases really start in the gut. You know, when you start destroying your microbiomes and butyrates, those are the friendly bacteria in your gut, then you're going to start really having some issues because things start backing up.
So now, can supplements help, or is this something that you have to eat whole real foods?
Absolutely, supplements help, but we still, once again, there's no way around going back to what our ancestors taught us. All of us have heard of sauerkraut. You know, it produces microbiomes and butyrates. Everyone's heard of kimchi. You know, there's certain little things that we just walk by and don't consume. Radish, things like that. Prebiotics. You got garlic as a prebiotic. Cacao, 90% chocolate. If you like chocolate, eat 90%. Stay away from some of the dairy that's in these chocolate. Yogurt.
So less dairy?
Dairy is very acidic, extremely acidic. All diseases live in an acidic environment. So at least be mindful when you consume dairy, when you consume gluten, you're feeding cancer cells, you're feeding, you're creating an environment of acidity in the blood. And that's where the viruses and bacteria. If you got allergies, why would you want to have, you know, some dairy?
So dairy, gluten-free foods, like, so you can still have breads, but not gluten.
Make your own bread.
Make your own bread.
Make your own bread. And go with the whole grain.
Whole grain?
Yeah, absolutely.
But so that but can still just, have gluten, but, yeah, but whole grain is just a better choice.
Right, but moderation. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't understand moderation. We make money, and then we think that the best food is the most expensive food, and that's the food that's hurting a lot of this.
What about pizza? How do you solve the pizza problem?
I don't eat pizza. If I do, and if there's listeners out there that loves pizzas, I'm not against pizza. I just really encourage them to take an enzyme, a really good quality enzyme after they consume their food. Because I want to leave you with this. 80% of the body's energy is for digestion. So when you have to be mindful when you put something in your body, if it's not bioavailable, if it's a pizza, 80%. 90% of the times you're going to feel tired and lethargic. Why? Because 7% is your heart. It's got to have that energy. Moving around is another metabolically active area. The brain's about 2.5 to 3 pounds, requires 25% of the body's energy. You're going to have what they now call in type 3 diabetes, and that's brain abnormalities.
So now where does Executive Armor come into play?
Executive Armor, and I have another product called Chuice, chuice.com, and Chuice is a chewable juice. It's the reason why you chew it is because you release the amylase in the saliva that breaks down complex carbohydrates. So that's the first stage of digestion. It's been many studies done from Emory to Georgia State that helps with the production of microbiomes to help in lower blood pressure, cholesterol, and so on and so forth. Executive Armor is a blend of herbs that I found in this country that if people consume them, they would at least help them with some of these conditions, like the first stage benign prostatic hypoplasia, and from pain. People have a lot of pain. Everyone's inflamed nowadays. If you consume certain compounds, you can stand it. It can stand, like my Pain Armor stands in a conversion of arachidonic acid, converting into the protein called prostaglandin E2. And then it has a super strong proteolytic enzyme, like the pancreas secretes, that dissolves that protein that causes the pain. So it's all natural, plant-based, back to the indigenous way.
So now if somebody wants to learn more about Executive Armor and your work, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
You can find me on Instagram, The Ladell Hill. That's T-H-E-L-A-D-E-L-L-H-I-L-L. And you can find me as well on Facebook. And I'm all over the country right now anyway, speaking on tour. And we need to speak because I'm working with a lot of mega churches speaking about how to get their health back by consuming the chemical compounds that's derived from plants.
Good stuff, Ladell. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
All right, Tracy, who's the headliner?
All right, so now we have Dr. Shalini, and she is our clinical pharmacist as well as a massage therapist, and she can speak to her world, which is amazing.
Well, Dr. Shalini, tell us about your work. It seems like you're touching a variety of places in the community here.
Yeah, that's right, Lee. I think massage specifically is falling under more of the preventative care that we've been talking about to this today in this last hour. So I liked what Dr. Bell said a little bit earlier about, you know, we're looking for a proactive. So proactive to me is multi-prong. Multi-prong, coming from my background, is both East and Western medicine. Mm-hmm. My journey really took me from clinical pharmacy, which my foundation, anatomy, everything is through Western medicine. And as I worked as an emergency room pharmacist for a decade and a half, I started seeing the power behind these agents, these medications, and started becoming a little disenchanted with the frequent flyers and that we weren't really being a part of the solution.
Right.
More part of the
problem. If it was so effective, why do they keep coming back?
Exactly. Exactly.
So then how did you kind of work into this other side of the brain here?
You know, I always, from the beginning, felt that the body was self-healing. And with that knowledge, body work was always a part of my life. I just never delved into it until this disenchantment occurred. And it was a pretty drastic decision, both financially and logically. It really doesn't make sense. And so I'm also coming here today to kind of help folks out there understand that if something's not healthy or you don't agree with it, ask questions, delve in more. You're not necessarily going against, you should be living your own philosophy.
Now, when you talk about massage, you're not talking about the massage that's like at the mall where they're,
right.
You know.
No, I'm talking about neuromuscular therapy, medical massage. This type of massage is the type of massage that you would need for preventive maintenance for your bodies. It's recommended for carpal tunnel all the way up to migraines. Mm-hmm. So that vast array of medical conditions.
It's therapeutic, right? So this is stuff to kind of solve problems. And you've seen it impact people's health and improve their...
Absolutely. I have a client that I've been working with for about 9 months weekly, and he was, he's in his 60s, late 60s, and he was rear-ended with an armored truck. And he was on a tremendous amount of narcotics and working with him weekly, removing the scar tissue in that focused area. We are now narcotic free. So I'm part of that plan.
And so people don't kind of connect the dots that that's a possibility, that outcome could occur through massage, right? That's
correct.
Not kind of obvious.
That
the
is
obvious
not
solution.
Obvious, right. And I think that's the point, is that we need to really promote other care besides medication. Mm-hmm. There's acupuncture, there's naturopathy, there's massage. And it's not all for luxury or because somebody on Instagram was doing it, that it actually should be a part of your routine.
So I guess that's a double-edged sword, right? That it's very popular on those kind of platforms, so then maybe people aren't taking it as seriously as a kind of a really well-grounded solution to
correct.
Some medical issues.
Yes, exactly. I totally agree with that.
So then how do you go about educating the public about how, look, consider this. It may not even be in their radar to consider massage or some of those treatments as solutions to medical issues.
Well, I think what it lends itself to is one patient or one client at a time. I'm a referral only at this point in time, but mm-hmm. I think that there's such a stigma around massage being luxury or, you know.
It's almost like pampering. It's correct. Not as it's, a, I'm solving a medical issue. It's more of like, oh, this is a treat.
It is, right. So AMTA is a big proponent of American Massage Therapeutic Association, is an association that has studies out there and then linking decreased acute coronary syndrome, better improving circulation post-surgery or pre-surgery.
Right. So does that come into play in some of this diabetes talk we've been, you know, in terms of circulation? Does massage help in any of those areas?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that, and also from a pharmaceutical perspective too, I have that both those unique background is the between healthy diet, regular exercise, massage, that also needs to be promoted. So absolutely with massage, you're increasing circulation to those parts of the body. You're also having another person looking at your body to see if there's any sores or open wounds or what is this going on. So it's a team approach at that point too.
And then how do you kind of integrate yourself as part of the team? Are kind of the medical people open to this, or is this kind of considered a little out there?
You'd be very surprised. I was very surprised that there was a number of surgeons actually are very, very interested in medical massage because they don't want to cut as much. They rather not cut. There's right. more infection. There's more harm. So that's what they want to avoid. Yeah.
So now what do you need more of? How can we help you?
Well, I you can text me if you'd like to learn a little bit more about medical massage. I'd like, and I'll, you know, discount your session with me for the first time, and I can give you my number for that.
But do you need more relationships with doctors? Like, do you, where do you get your referrals now? Is it just word of mouth through the patients?
Correct. So you're right. As of now, it's mostly word of mouth, and I've been really blessed for that. But integrative medicine doctors, surgeons, pain doctors as mm-hmm. well, even like Orange Theory, places where there's fitness and
people that care about fitness.
People right. care about fitness, exactly.
And then so that's what you're doing right now in your practice, is to just kind of educate people and serve the people through massage and these other methods?
Right. And then the other component of my work is movement re-education. So when you're coming to see me consistently, we're talking a lot about what you're doing day to day, because we're athletes. We're all athletes. We are using the same repetitive motions to perform our job successfully. So what can we dust in your
like even if your job is sitting at a desk?
Yeah, even if your job right. is sitting at your desk, exactly, or driving or, right. you know, on the phone all the whole time, you're definitely going to require some.
And there's some things you can do to kind of improve maybe your posture or do different things correct. Around the desk and so you don't get injured or
building
you don't.
Building body awareness.
Right.
Absolutely. Most people don't know what they're doing because they're just going as a machine. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now if somebody wanted to learn more, what's your coordinates?
678.
Yeah, no website?
No, I don't have a website, but I
Facebook,
have my
any social media, or you're totally off the grid?
I am off the grid, actually, but right. I am referral only for a purpose. Uh-huh. I really want serious clients to come to me.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you, Lee.
Now, Tracy, do you want to open it up to the floor to talk about some kind of general topics
sure.
about this, or you want to call it a day?
We could go on and on forever, actually, with this particular group. I'll, you know, throw it back to if you guys have any questions from ourselves or just from what you heard, or, you know, anything particular you remembered after the fact.
We started with Dr. Bell. Let's end with Dr. Bell. So now you've heard different kind of thoughts about this, and community is a recurring theme, I think, in everybody's work, that it's important to share with the community, educate the community. Is this what an individual needs in order? They need an ecosystem like this in order to be healthy nowadays. You have to be aware of your body. You have to be aware of the food. You have to be aware of kind of the social networks and the people that you're around in order to kind of live a healthy life nowadays?
Lee, first of all, this has been a fascinating discussion. I've learned a lot today too, and the panel's been fantastic, every one of them. I think the bottom line is this is really, and we say it in our world all the time, it's a team approach to amputation prevention. Well, this is truly a team approach in managing this particular population. it's everybody is part of the team, and it all starts with the individual too. You know, I tell my patients when they come to see me, you know, I can't do this all by myself. You're part of the team too. So I think the take-home message from my perspective is that the more patients become engaged in their own well-being, learn as much as you can, even simple things like reading labels when you go to the supermarket and just educating yourself through every possible source is the way to go. We've got so many educational resources at our fingertips now. You don't have to go to the library anymore, as you know.
Right.
We're truly in an information age. So,
but it's also information overload, and people don't know what information is real and what isn't real. And you got to really understand the agenda of the different players in order to understand what the truth or their truth is and what they're trying to.
And this is certainly true. But I think over time, the more you educate yourself, the more you're able to be able to discern what's legitimate and what is maybe not. Consider the source, you know, learn, be skeptical, you know, as a scientist too.
Right, skeptical but not cynical.
Correct.
Because it's easy
Correct.
To get overwhelmed with all this negativity and it seems hopeless when there really are things that you can be doing, practical things every day that can improve your situation.
Yes. And always be an optimist too. I mean, in my line of work, I have to be the eternal optimist.
Right.
And, you know, there's always, we can always do better and we're always trying to raise the bar, and it comes from, you know, within too. So never give up, never quit in this quest. It really does come down to what Dr. James was saying. It's quality of life. You know, it's not like flipping a switch. You know, you have to manage this every day. And to get out of bed every day and not have aches and pains is a blessing. And you want to maintain that as long as you can.
As long as you can. And don't do things that are kind of shooting yourself in the foot. You know, there's
Correct.
Things you can be doing every day that can improve your situation over time.
Yes, indeed.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Tracy. Tracy, you want to talk about your practice, your personal training practice?
I'm fabulous. Come see me at a Concourse Athletic Club. I know all these great people. On
That's
a series.
Part of what you get with you, is you get this whole network comes with
That's
you, right?
That's right. I come, when it's a one-stop shop. You know, I get you fit,
because
I feed
we
you,
talked about your food is medicine, exercise
yeah.
is medicine too.
Yeah. Yeah, and to go along with Shalini, I keep it short because my segment, most people, or what I do, most people already have a general understanding. The misconception and breakdown that comes is that they look at exercise as just to lose weight and to be aesthetically appealing, which is fine. Everyone wants to look great naked. I get that. But, you know, it's also a part of a therapeutic, life-extending situation. You feel better. You sleep better. You eat better. Your body produces things, it digests things. It's just a culmination of everything we've just talked about.
Right. And these things aren't in a vacuum. You know, eating healthy food is possible. There's ways mm-hmm. to eat plant-based food. It doesn't mm-hmm. have to taste bad. It doesn't have to be this thing
Correct.
That is a negative.
Correct.
And same with exercise. There's ways to exercise at all different
so
levels for all different people, no matter what where you're at.
So many. I mean, we have come along to where we have a personal trainer instead of a mirror. Like, you know, I love Peloton. I'm a spin instructor too. We have so many different ways at your fingertips to exercise at your house, outside your house, at the park, at the gym.
Right.
You know, so fitness has gone boutique. We're no longer in this one-stop shop, the LA Fitnesses, which, you know, I'm cool with. Concourse Athletic Club, I'm good with that too. We're still considered a one-stop shop. However, nobody really has a reason or an excuse anymore. Like, it's we're there.
Right.
You know?
Well, the information is there. There's no doubt about that. Like Dr. Bell said, to discern kind of the what's real and what's not, that's part of the challenge. You're overwhelmed with all this information.
Yeah.
It seems like why I can't do it. It's too overwhelming.
Yeah.
So, Dr. James, any closing
comments? Yes, I'm so glad
comments?
That you used the word overwhelmed. Because when we talk about lifestyle change, it's a process.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say you start small or you just do one thing consistently.
Right.
So many times when things are thrown at you. So whether or not it's not eating after 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock at night so that the digestive system can or it's I am only going to be doing my garlic smoothie. Mm-hmm. I can't change anything else right now.
Right.
But it's starting and being consistent until it becomes a habit,
right.
until they become. But too many times, someone would leave here saying, I have to do all of these things right now.
And so I'll do none of those things.
Exactly, because you can easily become overwhelmed. change takes place one at a time.
Right.
So start and just be consistent with one thing, and then you add something else, and then you add something
else. Right, those are building blocks.
Exactly.
And you don't have to do it all at one time.
Because it's easy to become overwhelmed, especially when you also have to juggle doctor's appointments with that.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Good stuff. Well, thank you all for sharing your story today, and thank you, Tracy, for putting this together. This is Lee Cantor. We'll see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.